You're listening to the Prepper Recon Podcast. For questions, comments, and podcast archives, go to PrepperRecon.com. Hey, Preppers and Patriots. Real quick announcement before we get into today's all-important interview, which I think might be the most critical podcast I've ever put out. The final installment of The Beginning of Sorrows, Book 3, Upheaval, is now available in audio, Kindle, and paperback. The book delivers a painfully realistic look at what I believe America will look like in the very near future. If you haven't started The Beginning of Sorrows series, you're really missing out. Get your copy today. And now for today's interview. Today's guest is NC Scout. He served our country in the U.S. Army as an infantry scout and a sergeant in one of the Army's best reconnaissance units. He now runs the American Partisan website as well as Radio Contra podcast. NC Scout, thanks for joining us and thanks for your service to our country and thanks for your continued service by educating the American patriot.
Thank you, brother. It's a huge honor to be here.
Yeah, well, it's an honor to have you on and we really appreciate your time to you're taking to talk to us today. Tell us first about your experience in the military.
So I served 7 years in the United States Army as an infantryman down on the line, then one of the Army's long-range surveillance companies, worked with some of the most amazing people in America, had three overseas tours, two in Iraq, one in Afghanistan, had a heck of a lot of fun doing it, and once I wrapped things up, it was time to go. You know, the Army was changing, things were changing, the world was changing a lot, and, you know, after Benghazi happened and we saw the lies and everything that came out with that, the writing was on the wall, and it was time to go. And from that point forward, I knew that, you know, my purpose in life, my mission was to train American patriots, get out there, share what I know as best I can, impart my knowledge and skills and to spread the knowledge, and make the God-fearing patriots among us, the conservatives, the people who truly love this nation, give us a fighting chance, you know, ground this stuff in reality because the fight is coming. It's on the doorstep and, you know, it's where we find ourselves in 2020 America.
And you mentioned that you're now using the knowledge that you gained in the military to, teach and train others. You also do live classes. Is that correct?
That's correct. My company, Brushbeater Training and Consulting, I run classes throughout the entire year. I try to offer the absolute most comprehensive number of classes, the broadest number of skills to every patriot out there, from communications, small unit communications, to medical skills, to wilderness tracking and wilderness survival, to small unit tactics with the scout course, as well as marksmanship. You know, this coming weekend I'm going to be running a AK class, Kalashnikov class. I have my carbine class that we cover this day and night, where, you know, I teach folks to use their weapons, individual weapons handling, and then we bump it up to the team skills, and then at night we integrate low light fighting with tac lights and all that stuff, but we evolve past that into night vision. And one of the big things that I take a lot of pride in is, you know, the patriot that's out there doesn't have to buy a mountain of gear to come to a class. You know, I tell everybody that if you don't have something, if something you don't, you know, you may not have, or a piece of gear that you're thinking about, but you're not sure if you're ready to pull the trigger on it. Hey, you know, if I have it, you come to class, You get hands-on with it, and you'll see the relevance. You'll see why you need that. And, you know, the theory of use and the ability to train with a piece of gear before you run out and spend a gargantuan amount of money, it really, really, it's been productive. And I've been able to, on my end, see the difference that it's made in the folks who have come out to class. I get to see that spark. And it's something that gives me a heck of a lot of pride.
Lots of preppers, myself included, have been largely focused on the economic frailties of America. I've certainly been aware of the possibility of a civil war. But I still feel like I've been caught off guard by the pace that this communist revolution has flared up. I suppose COVID was just too perfect of an opportunity to pass up for the Marxists. Either that, or it was all a coordinated, planned thing. And I guess if you weren't a fly in the wall, in the planning stages, we can never know for sure, but it certainly seems like it was an awful, lucky, incident for the leftist, lucky on the level of hitting like 5 state lotteries in the same day. Wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I agree completely with that, you know, and while I'm not going to sit here and say that COVID is a hoax and so on and so forth, I'm not qualified to make that kind of a statement. But what I will say is that it certainly has been exploited to the fullest. And the excuses that have been made, you know, we can't have in-person voting. Well, you know, when I was growing up and in school back in, you know, public education, when they actually did teach that we even had a constitution, much less read it, you know, we know that voting, there are very specific guidelines to how national elections are to be conducted. And one of the big things is that it is a secret ballot that is cast in person. That is according to the Constitution. You know, so when we have this mail-in ballot, there's, you know, even looking at it objectively, not from a partisan political stance or one party or the other, if we just look at this objectively, we can see that it's already not valid on its face. You know, even overseas, when I was in Iraq for the Iraqi elections, a couple of them actually, and they would vote. And when they voted, they stuck their finger in a vat of henna ink to prove that they had voted. And so they were doing this in person. Now, in Iraq's a third world country. They have all kinds of different diseases that are way, way more lethal than COVID. I mean, at the time, this was when MERS was going around, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. They had a 30% mortality rate. They still voted in person. Why can't we vote in person? And so I have serious questions about the credibility of mail-in ballots. And that's not because I'm a Trump supporter. That's not because I'm a conservative. That's not because I'm a patriot. That's because I have a brain. It's because I have common sense. And because I know that these people, behind the halls of power and government have done everything in their power to maintain their power. And so if we look at this objectively, you can see what the larger game is here. And so, you know, I think that what we're seeing play out in the streets is the very, very fact that they know that they are losing power. And this is the last play that they have. This is the last thing that they have. And they are going to get violent. And it's only going to get worse as we get closer to the election.
And this internal conflict that we're talking about, it's one of those things you see coming and you know it's going to happen, but then when it hits, it's really hard to believe that it's actually happening. What's your gut telling you? Do you think the riots and the protests are going to continue? They're going to intensify as we go into the election, and then you think that it's going to culminate somewhere right around the results? And do you think it's going to be something that we're going to see regardless of the outcome, whether it swings left or right?
So, bottom line up front, what we're seeing on the 10,000 foot level is a type of fifth generation warfare. And fifth generation warfare, a lot of folks are familiar with fourth generation warfare, which is usually small teams. You have small guerrilla bands that act, and then you have the guerrilla support, and then you have all the local actors that are openly aiding them or clandestinely aiding them. And that's fourth generation warfare, and the media plays a pretty significant part. Fifth generation warfare, on the other hand, is the mass mobilization of everyone. And this concept of warfare is not necessarily high intensity, although it can revert to fourth generation warfare at a specific point. There's a specific juncture behind that. But what we're seeing is an effort to overwhelm the security forces of a nation. And this is essentially the theory behind the color revolution, which is where we find ourselves. We can study the color revolutions of the former Soviet states. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Mika Brzezinski, who's a commentator and news anchor for MSNBC, big Marxian outlet, and she's very firmly on the left. But her father was a career diplomat, State Department official. His name is Zbigniew Brzezinski. He wrote the book on color revolutions. And so when we look back at that and study what his theory behind this was, and we understand what fifth generation warfare is, we will have a greater insight into what's occurring right now on our streets. So with the riots, with the looting, burning, and a complicit media, which plays a large part in all this, we're seeing an effort to destabilize cities first, but then whole regions. You know, last night in Kenosha, in Wisconsin, people finally dared to shoot back. You know, they finally dared to shoot back. Those folks, I mean, and you know, the video's up on America Partisan and a lot of other outlets. And, when we look at that and they say, oh, you know, the media's reaction will be, oh, these vigilantes shot these protesters. Well, the protesters were armed. The one that got shot in the head was throwing a Molotov cocktail. You know, they were attempting lethal force, and why is the media not calling it down the middle? So we have a lying, complicit media that's going right along with it. And so I think that it doesn't matter what we say or what objective truth, facts that we put out to the contrary, it's going to fall on deaf ears. So this whole thing is not only going to escalate, but it's going to get worse to the election day. And when we wake up the day after election day in November, early November, when we wake up the day after, we're not going to have a new president. We're not going to have results from an election. It's going to be contested. I think that's a foregone conclusion. And because we're not going to have results, because the left is not going to accept the results of the election. I mean, the president has done so many amazing things for this country. And while I don't agree with everything that he's done, we can easily say that he's got a heck of a lot better of an option than Joe Biden is, who doesn't even know where he is at any given moment. So, when we see that and we know that the left isn't going to accept the outcome of the election, they're already not happy. They don't want Biden as a candidate. I mean, and they said so. The Project Veritas videos were out there. They don't want him as their candidate. They wanted Bernie Sanders or as the guy said in the video that the cities were going to burn. Well, they're making good on their promise. They're out there. And if Trump is not reelected, there's going to be a lot of American patriots that aren't going to accept the results of that either, because we see what it is. I mean, anybody with a brain can look at this objectively and know that this isn't working. This is not a free and fair election. So, you know, I think it's only going to escalate, and there may be a brief lull in the violence in the winter as we get into the depths of the winter. But maybe, and then again, maybe not. But by next summer, when it starts to get hot into the warmer spring months and then moving into the summer, we're going to see some pretty serious levels of violence, I think.
And do you think Wisconsin, do you think that incident, you think that was our Fort Sumter moment, or do you think that's still something to come? And then also talk a little bit about the ongoing scuffles between Antifa and BLM versus patriots like Proud Boys and 3%ers. Earlier this week, we had a pretty serious skirmish in Portland between Antifa and the Proud Boys, and I saw body armor and flak jackets and paintball guns and ball bats, which is and everybody had bear spray, which is kind of an escalation from just throwing water bottles and taunting and the odd rolling around in the street by one or two people.
Right. We've had a low simmer for some time now. Conservative voices have been squelched, and even those who aren't conservatives per se, not even dyed in the wool conservative. I mean, Andy Ngo, for example. Andy Ngo, the guy on Twitter, independent journalist who's been covering the stuff in Seattle and Portland and elsewhere. Andy Ngo is a gay Vietnamese guy. He's not a conservative. Wasn't a conservative. And it was only until Antifa began to attack him that these guys are bad news. And they're coming after me. And all I'm trying to do is independent journalism. And so, it's only going to escalate, and it's escalated rapidly. We've had a slow build up to where we find ourselves now. And, with that said, I'd also refer, the listeners to Bleeding Kansas. Bleeding Kansas was the decade period leading up to the American Civil War where, pro-slavery versus pro-abolitionist activists on both sides fought a guerrilla war with one another. And it didn't stop when the Civil War stopped. It kept going. It kept going until around 1880 or so. There were minor flare-ups here and there. Jesse and Frank James and Cole Younger and their gang, Robin Trains, were all part and parcel of that. They were activists from Missouri who were Confederate guerrillas. So where we see ourselves, the correlation to that today is that we've had a slow simmer building up to this, and now the frequency and intensity of the attacks on both sides going back and forth are getting rapid. They're rapidly building up. And, last night in Kenosha, what we saw was conservatives saying, hey, I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm not taking this anymore. I'm not going to sit here and be a speed bump, and you're not going to destroy my business and my livelihood and everything I've worked for. I'm done with this. And a lot of other people are stepping up, and they're looking at that and saying, you know what? They did it. And I'll tell you, when the news reports came out from that this morning and the police were saying they were looking for the people that did the shooting and the FBI was there, I'm going to tell you, those patriots are not going to allow themselves to be arrested, because they're going to say, you know what? You allowed this. You allowed these people to come here and burn down businesses and trash and loot and all of the things that they're doing, and we're not going to take this anymore. And so if you're going to come and you're going to arrest us because we were protecting life, limb, family, and property, then you know what? We're not going to allow ourselves to be arrested. And So it is definitely an escalation on both sides, and I would not be surprised to see it just continue back and forth, because this is going to be an escalation for the left too. They saw that. They saw the pictures of the wounded and dead. I think there were two dead and one wounded, and now it's a pretty famous picture of the guy he took around in his right arm, but he was holding a Glock pistol in his hand. I mean, he was armed, and, you know, I'm sorry, if somebody's armed and they've drawn their weapon and they take a round, well, I mean, you were an imminent threat, and whoever shot you did what they were supposed to do. But for the left, they're going to see that, and they're going to say, you know, well, we're going to respond in force and in kind. And so now what's become the de facto standard is whenever there's an altercation with the police, regardless of what the facts behind the incident actually are, it's just going to give us an excuse to loot and burn down and destroy things that's not ours. And the left sees that. And that's what they're going to do. And so, yeah, I see this as escalating, and it's quickly transitioning into the open warfare phase, very, very quickly. I would be surprised, personally, if we don't see, mass shootings, especially when we know that a lot of these activists and so on and so forth are being brought in from other areas. I would not be surprised if we don't see something akin to like what has happened in Juarez, Mexico in the past, where people from a rival cartel are all on a bus or in a truck and they get stopped 10 miles outside of town and some really bad stuff happens. I would be surprised if we don't see that in the near future.
Do you think we're going to see Do you think this is going to stay contained to urban centers, or do you think that we're going to see this start to bleed out into more rural areas? And do you think that we ever hit a phase where it becomes sort of the cities against the small town, to where there's conflicts between the two?
We will. It will bleed out into the rural areas. You know, I was actually having this conversation with one of my best friends. He's a Marine Raider vet, and we've been close friends for most of our lives. And he's Iraq and Afghanistan vet also. But yeah, we were talking about how it's primarily an urban fight now, and we're just in the beginning of it. The thing is that these people who are out there, they're trashing stuff, they're burning things, and some of the pictures that came out of Portland were very interesting, because there was a picture that I saw of a business that had been burned and looted, and they spray painted on the side of the building, "Someday we'll rebuild this, but with love." You know, and so that tells me that they don't have a plan for the future. These people have no idea what they're doing. They just want to cause chaos. They don't know what they're doing, and they don't really know exactly how they're going to exert control or even what that takes over time to actually be productive and make an area productive. Now, if we look back a few months to the Chaz commune that was right there in the center of Seattle, I mean, they had 3 days. These people were anarchists, and 3 days they had a warlord. The warlord, whatever his name was, couldn't take care of the people that were there, and it was probably about a week later he was escorted out of there on a stretcher, crying. You know, so there's going to come a point in time where the chaos in the urban areas is going to branch out into the rural areas, because they need supplies. They know that people in rural areas are far better armed and usually far more supplied, but they have one critical flaw. They're not able to communicate in real time with one another. Now, Facebook and social media and stuff kind of works in favor of that in the near term until those outlets get shut down, if they get shut down. And I think that if things get bad enough, they will shut them down. But folks in rural areas have a harder time communicating and coordinating one another. And so in rural areas, you know, as opposed to urban areas and even suburban areas, you'd be able to stand up a neighborhood defense pretty easily and pretty quickly. In a rural area, it'd be much more difficult to pull that off. And so when we're talking about that, you know, you have to have a way to alert your neighbors that you're even under attack. And so I think the closest thing to that would be farm defense in South Africa, how they handled that. Farmers defending themselves in the former Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, how they handled that at the time with the farm attacks. And that's probably the closest correlation that we'll be able to see with what may come in the future for the rural areas. But what I can tell you is that after those first couple of successful attacks on farms and on farmlands in rural areas, the rural folks are going to wise up to it. They're going to wise up to it. And they're going to, you know, as we see here in North Carolina, I live in a rural part of North Carolina. We know who the outsiders are. We know who they are. We see them. And while we're friendly enough, you know, you're viewed as an outsider. And those folks are going to find themselves on the wrong side of the social ladder. Very, very quickly as word spreads.
Do you think we're going to see the regular army involved in this coming conflict?
If we do, it'll be to restore order. But what I mean by that specifically is they'll be used to protect critical parts of infrastructure. Power plants is a big one. Communications infrastructure. You know, I've used the example several times in other interviews in the past and in my writing of studying Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. How did Boko Haram come to power? And one of the things that they went after first was cell phone towers. And the Nigerian government was not able to exert control over the cell phone towers, and they cut out cell phone service, or Boko Haram cut out cell phone service. And then they were in turn able to control the flow of information to an area. So I think that we'll see the military at least attempting to protect critical pieces of infrastructure as this gets worse. Using the military in a peacekeeping role, however, would be a disaster. we've already seen that doesn't really work. Chicago, for example, they called in the National Guard, and one of the National Guard platoon leaders was taking a knee with the protesters. I mean, they didn't have weapons, and the ones who did have weapons that you didn't see, they didn't have live rounds for their weapons. I mean, what are these guys there for? You know, but if you do send in the military to attempt to restore order, I'll tell you that the left, that Antifa has had substantial training. They have cadre who have trained overseas. They have cadre. I mean, it's documented. This isn't conspiracy theory. It is a fact that in the Rojava region, the northeastern region of Syria, the Kurds up there, the YPG, was a home to leftist activists and international volunteers that went there to fight ISIS. And while this stuff was going on from 2014, 2015, 2016, we looked at it as that was a noble goal because they were fighting ISIS. But what we didn't realize was that they were there getting guerrilla warfare training to bring back to use later. Antifa began as a movement in Germany, and they really got the ball rolling and realized that they could jump in and help the Kurds out in their struggle. And the Kurdish people, even though I have a lot of admiration for them, they are overwhelmingly a leftist-oriented people. And it was a natural home to all this. And now these people have been brought back. So if the U.S. Army or the Marine Corps and the U.S. military in its capacity is used to fight a counterinsurgency, these are people who have training and have experience at being insurgents. And so while we can sit back and we can say, well, you know, oh, look at these guys. Antifa can't fight. And look at that soy boy over there and soy team six and all the funny memes. We're really underestimating them. We're underestimating their ability to organize. We're underestimating their ability, for all the other skills that they may have. And for me, I learned a lesson on my first deployment to never, ever, ever underestimate an adversary, especially one who is motivated and who knows what his end goal is. Antifa has all of those things. You know, Black Lives Matter has all of those things, the different groups. You know, here in North Carolina, we have another group that kind of is branched off from that called NC Born, North Carolina Building Our Revolution Now. And these people are serious, and they have I've personally seen they have exhibited a serious level of organization. So, you know, as far as the military being used, it would be to secure critical points of infrastructure, or at least attempt to secure it. That way they can, the government can maintain power, or at least attempt to. But using them as a counterinsurgency force, I think, is going to end up in a disaster.
And I think that most of the serious preppers, at least the ones that listen to this show, who don't have a military background, I think most of them are probably fairly squared away with food storage. Hopefully, most of them have moved as far outside of the urban centers as they possibly can, you know, given their jobs and what they have available to them, those choices. But I think, and then I also think that most are likely to have some means of defending their lives and property, but I very much doubt that many have the equipment or the skills to engage in a prolonged domestic conflict. Can you give us the mile high view of what they need to start doing right now to prepare for what's coming?
Well, the first thing that I would tell them to do is to look in the mirror. You know, be realistic. We've all been treated to the famous gun debates online and the ever present my stuff in my bug out bag and my inch bag, my I'm never coming home bag and all this stuff. You know, look at yourself in the mirror. You know, when I was in the Army, expert infantry badge testing, you had to be able to road march 12 miles with your combat gear and a standard rucksack on your back, 35 pounds. You had to be able to do that in under 3 hours. Now, this is for a young 17 to 24-year-old infantryman who does this every day. I mean, every Wednesday, we were doing a 12-mile road march. At least once a month, we were doing a 20-mile road march. We were doing this stuff all the time, right? Every day that you weren't road marching, you were running 5 miles. 2-a-days, PT, you know, hitting the gym all the time. How many people have the time to do that? How many civilians have the time to do that? You know, and injuries. You know, I don't move as well now in my mid-30s as I did when I was in my mid-20s. And I can only imagine that when I hit my 40s.
Let me tell you.
It's coming. Yeah. You know, I'm starting to have the issues with arthritis and all the problems kicking in, you know. So, for a lot of folks, be realistic. Look at yourself in the mirror. And that's not to put anybody down. It's to say, be honest with your real capability. You know, sitting here and saying I got a rucksack full of stuff, you know, and I'm gonna bug out. Where are you gonna go? I mean, realistically, and I've been doing this stuff for a long time now, and people that are saying, well, I'm just going to head out to the National Forest. Well, have you ever taken a basic survival class? No, but I'll know what to do when the time comes. No, you won't. No, you won't. That's a recipe for ending up like the Donner Party. You don't know what to do when the time comes. I mean, how many people have just a basic bookshelf with, wild and edible plants on it? You know, a reference on that, a reference on how to prepare wild game, having cast iron cookware, you know, because nonstick cookware has a lifespan on it, generally a couple of years, so many times in a specific temperature before those silicates begin to break down and it puts harmful chemicals in your food. So cast iron, on the other hand, cured in lard, will last generations, and it's completely natural and it's completely safe. How many people know this stuff? How many people are doing that? So look at yourself honestly and say, you know, have I moved past the, you know, I'm gonna magically escape and evade the Golden Horde for 50 miles or 60 miles on foot with an 80-pound ruck on my back when I've never rucked that far in my life. You know, you're going to tear your feet all to pieces. I mean, so I would say prioritizing preps would go like this. The first thing is look at yourself. You know, how many people out there can just go walk 5 miles? Not run, not, you know, be a CrossFit superstar, but just go walk 5 miles. You know, how many people can do that? Next, look at your footwear. What kind of boots do you have? Are they suitable to the task? You know, I learned very quickly that you get out of your boots what you put in them. And cheap boots are a recipe for disaster down the road. If you ever meet any infantryman, special operations soldier, anybody who spends a lot of time on their feet, they're going to have their preferences in boots. And you're going to expect to spend a lot of money on it.
What brand of boots do you use?
So I'm a big fan of, in the field, I'm a big fan of Danner. Danner makes just some outstanding boots. Asolo is a European company that builds boots for mountaineering. If I was going to be in the wild for a long period of time, I'm wearing, in the winter specifically, I'm going to be wearing Asolos because they're very well made. In the summertime, I'm always wearing boots that have drain holes in them. Danner makes a pair called the Reckoning. It's a very lightweight jungle boot, has drain holes so that when I'm moving in wilderness terrain, because we're always having to cross creeks and walking through swampy areas and stuff, my feet are going to be able to dry and they're actually going to be able to ventilate. And, you know, it's going to keep my feet from getting jungle rot from too much moisture. So some of the other really good boot brands out there, Merrell, is really good. Merrell makes high quality footwear, very durable footwear. There's a lot to name. I would say Salomon's excellent as well, and Altima. I had a guy come to the tracking class weekend before last, and he was wearing a pair of Altima. They basically look like Chuck Taylor tennis shoes, and I thought they were really cool because they were super lightweight. They're made completely out of canvas, and this guy, he's a bear hunter. He's a serious guy. He spends a lot of time out in the wild. He's former airborne, rangerback guy, and ranger battalion guy, and so he knows good footwear, and he was wearing them, and I was impressed with them. You know, and super lightweight. I think that would be a good option in the summer months as well. But moving on to your clothes, you know, have some durable clothes. I'm a big fan of Carhartt because Carhartt lasts forever. You know, and even the inexpensive options, you know, if you go to Walmart or wherever, the Dickies brand, cotton duck pants. You know, I've got several pair that I've had for almost 10 years now. And while they're faded and kind of tore up, they're still perfectly serviceable. You know, you want to have those kinds of clothes for a long period of time. And dress for the seasons. Dress for the seasons. Know what you need to have in the summer months. Know what you need to have in the winter months as well. Know how to stay warm. You know, so clothes are a big deal. Just having that wilderness awareness to get out in the woods, unplug your phone, get off the, you know, whatever safety nets you might have, computers on. So just get out in the woods, go sit out there and listen. Listen to the wild, listen to the natural ambience. And you're going to see that you're going to start to pay attention to more stuff. You're going to basically re-feralize your mind. But you wouldn't have had that awareness otherwise. You know, and for anybody that's listening to this and thinking, well, you know, hey, that's kind of getting into the hippy-dippy end of stuff. I'm going to tell you that having that natural awareness of the natural world correlates directly to the urban world. I'm telling you right now it does, because I go out in the wild and I know immediately when something's out of place. I know the presence of animals or the absence of animals, rather. The presence of them and the absence of them tell me all sorts of warning signs. Well, when I go into an urban area and the presence of certain types of people or the absence of certain types of people, it's those same context cues, and you begin to pay attention to that stuff, and so it is a direct correlation there. So your awareness is a big deal. That is a big prep as well. I would say the next thing on the list is communications. Standardize your ability to communicate. I have people who come to the RTO course. They bring, you know, a mountain of radio gear, and they get all these different brands and all this different stuff, and everything has to be programmed slightly differently, or the controls are a little different, or the biggest thing, they have a bunch of handheld radios and they all use a different battery. Have a standard. A set standard. You know, the Baofeng UV5R, really inexpensive, is $22 radio. It's super simple to use. They're worth having several of them. But even if you don't want to go that route, or you want to buy something nicer, that's fine. Just make sure that they're all using the same type of battery, and they all have the same way to program them, so that in the middle of the night, you know, and I have to grab it and go, or I'm in the middle of a patrol, you know, at O-Dark 30, and all of a sudden my gear doesn't work, I can sort it out, because I know that each piece of gear that we have is exactly the same. It's you know, the same across the board. It's what we used to call in the Army, dress right, dress. And the same is true for your weapon systems. You know, one of the big things that I don't want to say is a pet peeve of mine, because I try to accommodate as much as possible when people come to class. But one of the big things is when people have non-standard controls on their weapon systems. Like, for example, like the Magpul bad lever and all that. Learn to use your weapon system as is. And standardize on one weapon system, you know. So, like, you might sit and say, well, I really like the AK, and that might be true, but everybody else in your group all uses an AR-15. Well, you might want to standardize on the AR-15. But going further than that, you might want to standardize all on the same type of magazine. And you might want to standardize on all of the same type of ammo. That way, when you have malfunctions with your weapon, or something goes wrong with it, or, you know, whatever the case may be, you've eliminated a bunch of variables, you know, because I've had people bring AR-15s to class that just didn't work. You know, they were guns that they either built at home, or they, you know, got from Shady Bob's gun shop somewhere, and it, you know, it was a pawn shop special. And then they look at it and say, well, I don't understand why it doesn't work. Well, you have to narrow it down to a few different variables. So, you know, there could be all sorts of different things wrong with the AR. There's a lot of points of failure with that weapon. But if they're all the same, built to a specific standard, you can isolate what those issues might be. All the way down to running the same type of ammo, the same brand of ammo. And I know that if you're just late to the game getting in there today, buying ammunition is not an easy thing to do. It's almost non-existent and very expensive where you can find it. But having sameness across the board. Food preps. You know, you mentioned that a lot of people have that you hope that most of them are squared away, and I hope that they are too. You know, I grow food out of a garden. You know, I have a pretty large garden. We're able to eat out of it. We grow during the summertime, and then we have fresh vegetables for the late summer and into the winter months. Having a pressure canner, the skill of pressure canning, you know, when I was growing up, my grandparents and everybody of that Depression era generation canned food. Every single one of them canned food and raised their own animals, grew a garden, and canned everything because that was what you were going to eat on in the wintertime. I mean, they grew up in a period before grocery stores, you know, before Walmart. We didn't have that safety net. You just go down the street and have it, you know. So have that ability to pressure can, because your freeze-dried food should be your last option. Your freeze-dried food should be, I literally am starving, and I don't have anything else to eat. I'm going to eat freeze-dried food now. That should be kind of the order of things. And, you know, when you're going and shopping in the grocery store, pick up a few extra cans of food. I mean, you know, you don't have to go out and buy a whole pallet of Dinty Moore or whatever, but you can definitely pick up a few extra cans. Everybody can afford to do that. And that's going to be a big step towards that. And I would say the last part of that list, second to last, I would say have some hand tools, the ability to make basic repairs to your stuff, have a hammer, know some carpentry skills, definitely go a long way. And finally on that list, how many homes have a wood stove? You know, can you keep your home heated in the wintertime off the grid? You know, and when I teach classes out west, you know, every home out there has a wood stove. It's just a basic part of survival. And then growing up here in the South, our homes all had, the older homes all had wood stoves. But, you know, some of the newer homes, a lot of the newer homes and housing developments and stuff do not. And they are completely dependent on the grid for heating and for air conditioning and everything else. You know, so look at your house, too. You know, just because you have a bunch of stuff, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're prepared or that you even know how to use it. And I would say after that, get training. And not just me, because I'm a trainer. There's a lot of guys out there that are teaching survival skills, firearm skills, martial arts, and get engaged in it. Get engaged.
Let's talk a little bit about comms for a minute. Do you like digital mobile radio? Do you think that's a good means of making it more difficult for the enemy to intercept transmissions? And then also, I know most ham operators know that it's illegal to encrypt transmissions over amateur frequencies. But what about the military? Do they utilize encryption with DMR, or is that something you're familiar with?
Yes, so I do like DMR quite a bit, and I'll tell you that I've, in doing this for many years, I've been able to talk to a very broad number of individuals with a lot of experience, including my own. And for example, in Ukraine, in the conflict in Ukraine, the Russians were having a hard time once the Ukrainian guerrillas, and in turn, the Ukrainian government was having a hard time with the Russian guerrillas, the pro-Russian separatists, when they all switched to DMR. Because the Chinese DMR units that are imported have the ability to encode your transmission in a number of different ways. And so while DMR itself is open source, there's a number of things that you can do to get yourself off of the beaten path, so to speak. You can use the different color codes. That's one way to do it, because the way that DMR decodes itself, they have color codes, as well as the channel, as well as the digital protocol, so on and so forth. But they also have time. A DMR has to be programmed to the second. So it has an internal clock, and it has to be programmed to the second to be able to decipher what the other DMRs are trying to say to one another when the radios are talking to one another. So if you were to take a DMR and set the clock off just 10 seconds on a set of them, well, you know, now you're working off a beaten path. And that's not encryption, by the way. That's not encryption. That's just, I made a mistake. You know, I made an error here. I didn't program it properly. Oops. You know, it's not a big deal, but also, you know, the ham radio community is definitely an interesting one. And while we all want to stay legal and, you know, we're all rule followers and so on and so forth, you know, we also know how to take our equipment and become operational with it. You know, and so I'll say that I'm a big fan of DMR, but if all you have is analog, and analog has its strengths too. You know, frequently in class, I'll give an overview of DMR and what the digital units do, but the analog units are easier to work with. And so if I have a group of people who, let's say I live in a rural area and we know that we're coming under attack, and I have a group of people that I need to field communications gear to rapidly and teach them on the fly. I mean, we didn't have the ability to train before now, you know, and here we are. The big dance is on us. You know, analog has a lot of strength because I can teach somebody how to use that radio quickly, and they'll be able to fix it quickly as well in case it goes wrong. And all radios will. They're all going to take a dump on you at the worst opportunity. So for a radio operator to be able to fix it on the fly is a big deal. And analog reduces the number of points of failure that are there. Now, if you've got time to train and the guys are regularly doing it and you're out there doing it, DMR is a great option to have. But keep in mind that in Ukraine, not every unit on the ground that was fighting was using DMR. The DMR units, because they were more expensive, were used for select groups that were doing very special roles, because they had additional training and they had experience, they had training, they knew what they were doing, and so that was a good thing for them to be using. But the frontline guys, they maintained their Balfing radios because they were using them. I mean, that was the primary means of communications, and they were doing this in Syria as well. The nations of the Arab Spring, you saw Balfing radios and similar stuff that was being used across the board. But what I'll also say to that is that if you are standing up your community defense rapidly, you know, analog is really a good way to go because it keeps things simple. The big thing to remember is everybody should keep their transmissions very short. And, you know, if somebody else is talking on the radio, you know, don't transmit, don't step on them, just, you know, let them get it out. and be done with it, and then answer them back. So keeping those basic radio protocols right there is going to be a really good way to keep everything organized. What I'll also say on that is the Baofeng, and another strength is that they are incredibly simple to use. And even the DMR units, Baofeng's DMR units, are still fairly simple. You know, they're not overly complicated to use or to program, but the Baofeng UV5R is really, really simple. And there's a plethora of accessories out there for it. Different microphones, all kinds of little interesting things that you can do with it. But what I will say to that is that if you, no matter what radio it is that you have aside from the Baofeng, say you step it up with some nicer gear like ICOM or Yaesu or Kenwood or whatever, get a Mars Cap mod. And what a Mars Cap mod stands for is Military Auxiliary Radio Service, Civil Air Patrol. And it used to be that Mars was an auxiliary, and Army Mars is still around, and Air Force Mars, I think, is still around. But they don't do the same things that they used to do. But what this does is it opens up your radio. It free bands it. So if you have a dual band mobile, for example, normally when it comes from the factory, it's only going to be usable on the amateur radio band. But if you open it up, then you're going to be able to use it on MERS, which is a license-free VHF service, which is five channels. It's 151.82 megahertz through 154 megahertz, but it's five channels, so you'll be able to use that. You would be able to use the FRS / GMRS. So FRS is the little bubble pack radios you can get at Walmart, like the Motorola Talkabouts and the Midlands and Cobras and stuff. You can use that as well. And it just gives us the most options. It gives us the most options for using our radio equipment. You know, because if you have people that show up, it's unrealistic to expect that everybody's going to go out and get a ham radio license. That's unrealistic. You know, should more people get into amateur radio for preparedness and emergency use? Absolutely. But the reality is that not everybody is willing to do that or has the time to do that, and that's fine. And if we're talking about creating ad hoc communications networks for preparedness groups, for community defense, not everybody's going to have an amateur radio license. So using those license-free options is going to be very, very important. And on that note, too, looking over at my own communication setup over here in my shack, don't overlook the capabilities of CB, also, of Citizens Band Radio, and you should probably have one with your communications gear, because CB is available in every truck stop across America, everywhere, every truck stop, every, you know, in the rural South, most gas stations, you can at least find coax cable and CB stuff. But you go up and down the interstate, you're going to find, CB shop at literally every truck stop. You know, that's a huge advantage because that means that a lot more people have CB radio out there than they do other radios. And with CB, you know, if I'm usually CB only pushes 4 watts out, but if I have it, you know, everybody has CB, you can create a relay network very, very quickly. With, you know, oh, hey, Joe over there has a CB in his truck and he's got a really nice antenna on it. Well, hey, Joe, you know, do you mind monitoring the radio? You know, between this hour and this hour, hey, that's no problem, you know, or he's going to be on guard duty. I don't need to equip him with a radio now because he already has his own in his truck and he knows how it works and he knows how to use it. So, you know, that's CB is frequently overlooked as either useless or, you know, it's old and we just don't get it anymore. But it has a big advantage. It has a really, really big advantage. And, you know, at the end of the day, we have to be able to put to work whatever gear we have, you know, because there's going to come a day that, you know, Amazon's not delivering anymore. And, you know, we're not able to just go grab what we want off the shelf or have it shipped to us 2 days prime or eBay or any of that. And what you've got is what you've got, and you got to make it work.
Do you have any thoughts on using small drones for gathering intelligence or battlefield situational awareness?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I said not that long ago that, you know, it's the technological advantage at the ground level today is light years past what it was even 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And drones are a big part of that, the proliferation of drones that are out there. I've had people that have brought drones to class, and, you know, the ability to have an eye in the sky, especially one that's small and doesn't make a whole lot of noise and also is very power efficient, that's a huge thing. That is a huge advantage. Because I can send up a drone, and even, so let's say I'm on the other side, and I see the drone in the air, and I know that it's looking at me. I have no idea where the operator is. I don't know where the drone operator is, but that drone has spotted me. And so that team on the ground, the drone operator, and those riflemen that are with him, or whatever their purpose might be, now they know that I'm there. So having a drone as part of your preparedness plan is a huge force multiplier. You know, and force multipliers are all those things that supplement the actual manpower that we have on the ground. It's in the Army, we use the term called enablers because it enables our team to do more things than we otherwise would be able to do. And a drone, you know, I think that with the inexpense that a lot of really decent drones are out there, I mean, you know, I was looking at a couple on Amazon and just trying to get a feel for what's out there today. And, I mean, some of these have really nice cameras and nice setup with them, you know, for $70, $80, you know, and man, I mean, this is something that we wouldn't have dreamed of having. I mean, I remember, you know, 14, 15 years ago when the Raven, which is used in the Army, is something that we had at the small unit level. And the Raven was super expensive, and it was big, and, you know, you had one guy who toted it around in the backpack and had to throw it in the air. We would have killed for some of these kids' drones. Because they're small, they're light, they have a better camera on them, they're easier to fly. You know, a four-rotor gyrocopter is a heck of a lot easier to fly than a, you know, the Raven that had the big fold-out wings on it and stuff that used to crash on us a lot. Just really, really cool features on this stuff. So, yeah, definitely worth having, definitely worth having.
What's the best bang for your buck when it comes to night vision? Let's say somebody wants to do Gen 3 white phosphorus. What's kind of the Toyota Camry of Gen 3 white phosphorus as far as a brand that you can get a good middle of the road that's going to serve you well and be durable, dependable, and not maybe stay to where it's not L3. Quite as, I mean, they're all expensive, but
right.
What's the best bang for your buck?
I would say L3. L3 makes EOTech.
Okay.
So anybody that owns a EOTech will recognize that name. The L3 brand name. L3 makes a PVS 14. I'm a big fan of the PVS 14. There are lesser expensive units out there. The PVS 7 Delta which covers both eyes when you're wearing it on your head. Nothing wrong with a 7 Delta. It's a little bit heavier than the 14 because it's a larger unit. Nothing in the world wrong with it. And it's a little easier to drive with a PVS 7 Delta as well because you don't have as many issues with depth perception because it's covering both eyes. But I would say that the 14 made by L3 is probably the best bang for the buck out there because, you know, it's L3. They're a military contractor. They build the 14s for the U.S. military. And it's made to their spec, which means it is durable, and it is good to go. And, you know, I'm a big fan of multi-purpose gear, you know, getting the most out of my equipment, possible. And one of the big strengths behind the PVS 14 is that it's a monotube. If I'm running a prismatic type optic on my weapon, like an ACOG, Primary Arms makes some, fixed power optics, which are the prismatic optic is a magnified optic. It's kind of compact. You know, the ACOG is probably the most famous one of that. But I can mount that PVS 14 in front of my ACOG for static security. So if I am at, you know, I'm in a hide site where I'm observing something where I might also have to use my weapon, you know, mount that PVS 14 in front of my ACOG, and I'm good to go, right? And I'm able to observe it. And, you know, to take it off and then put it on my back on my head, it's not really that big of an issue. You know, so the 14 has an advantage there. The 14 is also lightweight. You know, so it's just one tube. It's a monotube. So when I have it on my head, you know, you're going to get a neck ache and everything, and you're going to have some issues, especially the first couple times you wear them. But once you get used to it, wearing it at night, it's not that big of a deal. The PVS 14, when we got issued them and they were phasing out the 7 Deltas, you know, it was a world of difference. We loved them because they were so much lighter. And, you know, I think that the PVS 14 is a great way to go now, while you can get them, you know, while you can get them. The fact that military grade night vision is on the market today, you know, that civilians can buy is amazing because, you know, I've said many times now when we were overseas, our big thing that we just used to pat ourselves on the back about is we own the night. You know, we're doing night raids because the enemy doesn't have night vision. The enemy can't see where we are. And we've got our, you know, I've got my PEC 15 on my weapon. You know, I can shoot at night and you never know I was there and all this stuff. And then the attack on the Pakistani naval station in Mehran happened when we were in Afghanistan. And we saw the pictures coming out of that of these Taliban guys that were wearing night vision. They were wearing Russian units and Chinese units and captured American night vision sets. And, you know, we said, uh-oh. You know, now we know that they have that night vision capability. And while we didn't specifically see it in Afghanistan in all cases, you know, hey, it's there. That threat is there. And so now, you know, what I was just saying about how the U.S. military has never faced, I don't think any military in the world has ever faced a more technologically advanced insurgency as what looks like is shaping up right now. They've never faced an insurgency that has night vision capability either, and the ability to fight day or night. You know, it used to be that nighttime, well, the fighting's going to cease and whatever. And, you know, in Vietnam, guys that were on sentry duty didn't want to smoke because that's the only way a sniper would be able to pick out somebody at night is by the cherry on a cigarette, right, looking through a scope. Well, you know, that stuff now with a night vision optic in front of a decent scope on an AR that's been accurized, a free float tube and all that, you know, folks are in real trouble. They're in real trouble. So, you know, and that goes for both sides. I mean, there's some heavy hitters with Antifa. You know, anybody that's listening to this and thinking, well, you know, that's a good thing for the Patriots side, because there's a lot of combat vets that are on the side of the Patriots that are patriotic Americans, and we know what we're doing. And that's true. But I'm going to tell you guys, don't get into the normalcy bias of thinking that the left doesn't have these skills too, because I'm telling you for a fact, they do. You know, I mean, I worked with some guys who, you know, were very squared away and who know what I know, and they're on the left side of the spectrum. And so for us to sit and say, well, you know, the left can't fight and the left can't do this, can't do that, we're only seeing the beginning, folks. You know, but I would say that if, you know, having any type of night vision is better than none at all. And, you know, even if you're that guy that's out there and, you know, you're rubbing two nickels together to get a dime at the end of the month, having a Gen 1 unit, you know, like, I've seen some pretty decent ones made by Pulsar. The Gen 1 units are about $500 or so. Hey, if that's all you can afford, literally that's all you can afford, and $500 is not a small amount of money either, you know, but that's all you can get, then get it. Because getting what you need now is better than wishing you had it later on down the road and not being able to get it. And, you know, I'll also say on that note that battlefield pickup should not be your first plan. You know, it comes in handy, sure, if you come across stuff, and you might. Great. Excellent. That's awesome. But I don't use battlefield pickup as, you know, my plan, you know, if that makes sense.
Sure, absolutely. And C-Scout, we really appreciate everything you're doing for the Patriot community. We thank you for your service to our country, and we thank you for the time you spent with us today. Tell everybody where they can find your work, where they find your blog, and then there's a separate website for training, and then the podcast is accessible through the blog. So tell everybody where they can find all of your channels.
So my original site, brushbeater.wordpress.com, I've got my training schedule that's up on there. I also have a resources library page. I've got a bunch of hard-to-find military field manuals and references, and I've got Where There Is No Doctor, Where There Is No Dentist, medical references, intelligence references, small unit tactics, a lot of obscure stuff too, like the Special Forces Antenna Handbook, for example. But they're all on there, completely free to download. You'll have PDF copies of it. My training schedule is up on that site. American Partisan, AmericanPartisan.org, daily content going up, you know, useful skills, useful articles that are on there, current events, news, you know, all the authors over there have real world bona fides. Matt Bracken is you know, one of our fellow authors, and Johnny Mack, and Patriot Man, and Sam Culper, and just a whole crew over there, JC Dodge. You know, American Partisan, I'm very active over there, and I have a podcast that's up weekly, you know, as I have time for it in the training schedule. But it's called Radio Contra, and I normally will cover a couple of current events things, and I normally cover some of those skills and elaborate on those skill sets that you need for living in uncertain times.
Yeah, and for all the listeners out there that have been listening to Prepper Recon for years, and you know the economic stuff, you know most of the spiritual stuff, I cover that. The food preservation and food storage and growing, and we've talked a lot about comms and stuff, and this is for right now, for where we're headed right now, NC Scout is putting out the information that you absolutely have to get. So go over to American Partisan, listen to all those old episodes of the podcast, and read the articles. This is the stuff you need to get your brain moving in the direction that you're going to need to move to preserve yourselves, your family, your property, and your country. So, you know, I don't do a weekly show anymore. In fact, this is the first guest interview I've had since I was in Florida last winter. So hopefully I'm going to be doing some more. NC Scout, I'd love to have you back on in October as we get a little bit closer to the election. And there was so much content that stuff that I want to ask you that I didn't even get to today. So really love to have you back on in October if you can make the time for us.
Absolutely. It'd be a huge honor, man. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you, and God bless.
God bless you.